But here, on the very rim of known space, justice is a long way away.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to the Space Game Junkie Podcast. I, as always, am your co-host, Brian. Joining me, as always, is your co-host, Spaz.
Intelligently designed, allegedly.
Not this guy. your co-host, Julie.
Hello from the land of the eclipse.
Oh, yeah. Did
that
you guys...
does not narrow it down.
It really doesn't. Did you guys actually see it? I don't remember.
My friends and I sat there in our front yard. We watched the eclipse. We had our glasses on.
Oh, good.
And we played the song that is on kind of Bonnie Tyler's song about,
yeah,
you know.
Bonnie Tyler, Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Yeah.
Turn Around. Yeah, love that song. Your co-host, Thorsten.
And I am surrounded by quite a few books from today's guest.
Your co-host, Jacob.
Books.
Ook.
Books.
That's my little librarian reference from Discworld. And finally, your co-host, David.
Please insert funny quote here.
Charming.
So, friends, we have a guest today. I know it's been a while, but we have a guest today joining us. Oh, John, I forgot to ask. Where are you calling from? I forgot to ask that.
Maryland, East Coast, United States.
Ah, Maryland. What a lovely state. Spent a lot of time there in my youth. Joining us from Maryland, John Ziegler. Right? That's correct. Oh, good. John Ziegler, longtime role-playing game author, designer, developer, here to talk to us today about... So, friends, we've had Ken Burnside on the show before to talk about his games from Ad Astra. And Ken reached out to me because John and he worked together on a new... Is a supplement the right word for this? Is that the... Is that what you would call this, a supplement?
Oh, the supplement to anything. It's game system agnostic, but it's appearing as part of Ken's nonfiction line.
Right. Oh, interesting. So it's a world building book, basically called Architect of Worlds. It's big, y'all. It's almost 200 pages. It's a deep.
It's 191 pages of nerd shit of the highest quality.
It is supreme nerd shit, and it's even too nerdy for me. That's how nerdy it is. I'm pretty goddamn
pure,
nerdy.
Undistilled, unfiltered, 100% nerdium in a PDF.
Nerdium. How is
also,
no one... go ahead.
I wanted to say, as we get started out, a lot of work for Steve Jackson Games. Wow, respect.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll talk about that. I just wanted to circle back. Nerdium. How has that not been used as some kind of thing in a thing? Like, that is a great word,
I'm
Jacob.
I'm honestly surprised.
I'm certainly
really like that word. Same with McGuffinium. I am a huge fan of the word McGuffinium.
I thought unobtainium was peak, peak bullshit in that regard.
Nerdy. Unobtainium. Well, you've obtained it. What now?
And there's tangent number one. Welcome, folks. Welcome, people. We're back. John, if you don't mind, for an idiot like me and maybe people who don't know what this is, can you basically give us like your elevator pitch? Like, how would you describe this to someone who doesn't even know what it is?
Sure. If you think about it, most science fiction tabletop games, a lot of science fiction authors, a lot of developers for other properties, there's at least some interest in building fictional star systems, planetary systems, planetary surface conditions, and at least trying to be kind of sort of plausible with respect to what we think we know in the sciences. Now, this isn't an absolute necessity. There's lots of folks out there who are perfectly happy to roll some dice against some lookup tables and go, aha, desert planet with feudal government, and here I go. I'm ready to go.
As an avid Stars Without Numbers player,
there's a long thread in tabletop role-playing games in particular, stretching all the way back to the late 70s, of why don't we see if we can apply some of what we think we know about the science here?
Right. And that's where, I'm going to be honest, folks, I tried to read this thing. I'm too dumb for this thing. I tried to read it. I'm way too dumb.
The book is clearly going to be for a limited audience. I've joked, and in fact, Mark Miller, who owns the science fiction role-playing game Traveler, chuckled about this. This is probably the first role-playing game adjacent book ever published that has a raft of actual citations to scientific papers in it. So, yeah, if you're interested in, you know, the book is kind of, okay, planetary science for dummies. With it, you can roll through and develop fictional pieces of space that at least pass the smell test. But if you want to dig further into the actual technical papers or the scientific research, then there's lots of pointers in the book that can take you there.
Now, I'm curious, where did the idea for this come from? Did there seem to be a need for this? Did it come out of just someone's idea? Where did the impetus for this come from?
Well, like I said, a lot of this goes way back. The classic role-playing game Traveler, one of the earliest products it ever put out was the sixth book in the core system. Remember, Traveler used to come with these little black books, and the sixth one in that series was the Scouts book. It was all about exploration. And a good chunk of that book was a system for rolling up stars, planets, moons, planetary systems that would work in the Traveler game, but that at least were kind of in the same ballpark as real science as it was understood at the time. So there are other science fiction role-playing games since then have done similar things. As it happens, I kind of backed myself into being the expert on this stuff. I ended up writing three of these for GURPS and GURPS Traveler over the years. Two of them for GURPS Traveler, one for the fourth edition of GURPS Space. Always the understanding is, yeah, if you want to wing it, if you're looking for something that just has dramatic possibilities, that's cool. But if you want to take a stab at the real science, like, for example, science fiction writers like Paul Anderson or Larry Niven or Hal Clement have made a history of doing, then this kind of system is useful for that. Okay. Like I said, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, when I was doing a bunch of work for Steve Jackson Games, I ended up writing three different systems for doing this kind of thing. The last of those was the fourth edition of GURPS Space. And that was published after a couple years after the big boom in exoplanetary science had started. We were starting to detect planets around other stars. And of course, by today, we've detected thousands of them. And almost immediately, we were becoming aware that some of the old models for how planetary systems form and how they're structured, by looking at our own, of course, just didn't fit the facts that we were seeing out in the galaxy. So this caused all sorts of havoc in the astronomical community. Okay, our old models obviously don't work. This is how science works. The old model doesn't work. Okay, how can we explain that? How can we come up with a new and better model? So GURPS Space, which, if I recall, was published in, let me double check, 2006. Actually, it took a stab at some of the new science that was coming out at the time. But, of course, the last 20 years or so, planetary science has just been absolutely revolutionized. It's a great time to be an astronomer. So even what I did in 2006 isn't really sufficient anymore. So about 8-9 years ago, I decided, okay, I'm going to start writing a new version of this book. I'm going to make it not connected to GURPS or to any other specific game or game system. It's just going to be a basic book on the science that role-playing game players, referees, science fiction writers, film developers, video game developers, anybody could use this and sort of go through this process. And I kind of worked on it off and on for about 8 years now. It was never at the front of my project queue, but it was always in there somewhere. So that's kind of where this came from. This has kind of been a lifelong quest for me to figure out ways to do this plausibly. And this book is the result.
Can I just say, when Brian said board game, I looked at this and I said, what? Come on. And maybe it's because the first time I saw the word Steve Jackson game, and I will admit, sorcery is never more than outside of my arm's reach because it lives on my phone. and I saw this, and the first thing I thought about is a conversation I had with one of my editors, and I said I used a turn of phrase in my book that's coming out this year. It said he was the best in the system, and her first comment was, "What system?" And I said, "You know, I don't know." And I thought about this book, and I saw this book, and I thought about a book that came out not too long ago by Richard Bartle called How to Be a God, which is kind of in a similar vein. But, you know, I said, I wish when I had been through the first draft of this book, I think I'm my third now, that I'd wish I had this as a resource, because she said, one of the owner of the publishing company said, you need to have something that's like a toy truck. And I said, what? She said, well, Stephen King does this. Have a little world that you write about in your spare time just to take your mind off it. And I started to write something about this, and it was a desert world. And I said, other than just duplicating what Dune is, I said, I don't have anything to use for a resource. And now I do. And it's like, I approached this from a whole different standpoint, and I said, I wish I had had this sooner. And so thanks for the resource.
I do come to this from the direction of tabletop role-playing games, because that's where I was doing a lot of my writing and editorial work back then. But I also write literary science fiction, and it's fully the intention that this book may very well be a good resource for actual science fiction writers. In fact, apparently C.J. Sherry has already contributed a blurb for the back cover and has a copy of her own, because Ken Gurnside does occasional consulting work for her.
Wow.
Ken also tells me Ken tells me there's another well-known science fiction writer who is going to be getting a copy of this and has already contributed a blurb for the back cover, and he won't tell me who it is. He'd be very clear about it. So until I actually until I actually see the back cover, my wife and I literally have bets as to who it might be. So I have a couple other not top tier, but definitely published science fiction authors who are interested in this as a resource. And of course, if you look in the how to write science fiction genre of how-to books, you'll get books that are kind of like this, maybe not as detailed. So it's fully intended that that's going to be part of the market for it.
Well, you know, when I was talking with another author a number of years ago, and she writes hard science fiction, and I don't do that, but it's just mine is all down to a particular planet. But she said, you know, if you've got any kind of space travel in your game, you really got to know your stuff. And I said, that's why I've avoided it altogether. And, you know, I saw this kind of book, but, you know, I never occurred to me to equate this with a board game, but yeah, it's an amazing resource.
Yeah, I'm floored by how much stuff is in here. Like, honestly floored. Mm-hmm. It's I mean, and if you're smart enough, yeah, I could see you using this for anything. I think I sold it to the team as a tabletop thing because that's where I, you know, that was my entry to it from Ken. But yeah, you could see anybody using this. You know,
I mean, I'm a hobby astronomer, and I was really surprised. I didn't expect this much detail and research from a game supplement, to be honest.
Yeah, a lot of what I've been doing over the last 6 to 8 years is literally researching. I had bits and pieces of what turned into this book as far back as 20 years or so ago when I was doing the work with Steve Jackson Games. But to pull it all together in one book and make sense of it as a connected system, that took a lot of work and research. Not to mention, the science keeps moving. I have literally had to rewrite sections of this book. I can't begin to count how many times while I was writing it, simply because, oh, hey, here's a paper about some new bit of science that, well, crap, the system won't handle this, so I have to go back.
Science is faster than your writing.
Sometimes, yeah. I literally last fall, I think October, November, I published to my patrons and to my writing blog, okay, as of today, I'm drawing a line. Any new science that comes out after this point, that's going into the next edition or into a supplement. It's like a good novel. It never gets finished and it gets abandoned.
Well, honestly, I'm not really surprised because I follow the developments of the astronomical science very closely, and what happened over the last 15-20 years is just mind-boggling. Mm. It's just mind-boggling.
We have so much better understanding of how the early history of our planetary system went than we had even 20 years ago. It's really a great time to be even an amateur astronomer.
Well, you know, I wish I had had the part designing world surface conditions before. Mm-hmm. I needed that for when it gets to the point of the book where there's something orbiting in space. And I said, oh, my God, started these articles start to go way over my head because I was a business major. And I said, oh, my God, I need something like this. And but I also wanted to ask you, when I started to look about some of your history and at one point, one of my editors, she said, okay, do you want to run under a pseudonym? And I said, why? You know, I guess, are you afraid somebody's going to come and get me? You'll stand in line to form to the left. But I see you've got all these different pseudonyms, and I got to know where some of them come from, because it's like when I first logged on, somebody said, oh, everybody is getting ready for the show. And I said, no, it doesn't start for an hour. And who the devil is Shuriken of Akkad? I said, that's not John F. Zeigler. And I said, somebody just snuck in the back door or something. And then I looked at some of the pseudonyms and I said, oh my God, there's got to be a story behind that. And if there isn't, make something up.
There is a story behind Shuriken. When was this? It would have been close to the end of when I was writing for Steve Jackson Games. Like I said, I was at least the co-line editor for GURPS Traveler for a couple of years with Warren Wiseman. And one of our last really big projects was a GURPS Traveler book set in what's called the Interstellar Wars era of the Traveler universe. That is not thousands of years in the future like the main setting, but just a few hundred years when humans from Earth are the plucky underdogs starting to expand into the galaxy. The primary opponent culture in the Interstellar Wars era is a galactic empire also of humans. There's a story behind that. And a lot of the prior material for that was vaguely, these humans had a vaguely Mesopotamian origin. A lot of the names and whatnot were sort of pseudo-Akkadian, things like that. The language, or some of the words in the constructed language that have been come up for them. So I did a little bit of research on Mesopotamian history. Now, my personal historical core is classical Greek. But I dug into Babylonian Akkadian history, and one of the people I was most fascinated by was Sharukian of Akkad. In English, he's sometimes called Sargon the Great. He was probably the first human being that we know of to actually establish an empire anywhere on Earth. He established a widespread empire across what's today Mesopotamia, which unfortunately didn't last long beyond his children. And we know a little bit about his biography because we have records of at least the propaganda biography for this guy. So he kind of fascinated me as one of the first really realized individuals in human history. So I kind of took him. I used that name in the GURPS Traveler Interstellar Wars book. I kind of took that name as my internet nom de plume. And I've used it ever since on the internet. So when I'm writing fanfic or derivative fiction or posting to Reddit or what have you, it's on Sharukin. Now, I should probably make clear, I'm aware of the other guy who uses Sargon of Akkad as his pen name.
I was going to say, yes.
Yeah, well, first off, I have priority.
What's this? I don't know this whole thing.
There's a alt-right wing young politician in the UK who uses Sargon of Akkad as his blogging address. And I have occasionally had people come to me and go, oh, hey, I love your work. And it's like, wait a minute, what work are you talking about?
Which work?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh,
no. Want it clear. I have priority. I was using Sharukin and Sharukin Akkad long before he came along. And I wasn't going to give it up, just to avoid that confusion. Fortunately, anybody who knows me, his politics and mine are nothing different. We've never communicated as far as I know, but yeah, confuse.
It's like that poor online retailer called Gamersgate that's been around since the mid-aughts.
Now, in the meantime, I write nonfiction under my own byline, John F. Ziegler. I write and self-published fiction, original fiction under a pseudonym, mostly just to keep those things separate.
Go ahead.
I mean, I'm such a small scale author that it probably doesn't matter, but I remember things like, for example, Harry Turtledove, when he wanted to write some straight, historical fiction, for a long time, he published it under a pseudonym because he didn't want to mix those two genres on the shelves. That's really the only reason I do it.
Well, you know, when I tried to first Google your name, Ziegler, the first thing that came up was some kind of mom's dancing group here locally. And then I also got a Ziegler Dodge. And I said, okay, John F. Ziegler. And then I got it. But I have since, because I said your draft of your work now lives right next to, as a resource, right next to Steve on my phone, right next to the Steve Jackson Sorcery. But, you know, I said, well, I got to support this. I got to buy this. I haven't seen it come out anywhere. Is it published yet, or where could we go to help support your publication of this?
It is available in pre-order. I turned over the draft that you guys have seen was my last pre-editing draft. It's my final draft. What actually appears is probably going to be a bit different, although the science and the math and the design sequence will not change. Basically, I turned over that draft to Ken Burnside, back in February. And Ken has been having a rough couple months with illness and with other projects.
Oh, no. That have
been
taking
priority. Yeah, he's been having some difficulty. But he tells me that we speak almost every week at least, and he tells me he's getting closer and closer to having his final draft edits done. So as soon as that's done, he's going to turn them over to me. I'm told it won't take me probably more than an evening or two to produce the final release draft. And at that point, he already has the covers from his printer. It's just going to be a matter of printing the innards of the book and starting to ship orders.
Well. Give us a link or something when it comes out.
Hang on a second. I have that right here. Let me drop it into the podcast studio chat. There you go. Pre-orders of the print edition are available there. There will be a PDF edition. There will be a PDF edition as well, which will probably be available very quickly after I finish working through his edits. And now I can't predict when that's going to be. Every time I make a prediction, some other disaster happens to Ken. So soon, I hope, but we'll just have to see.
Whenever you get a PDF edition, I'll be the first one in line to buy it, because that's how I do all my reading.
Makes sense.
This is going to be a print edition. The first version that comes out is going to be print.
Yep. The link I just gave you is to the pre-order page. Right now, the only thing you can pre-order is the print edition. But I'm told as soon as the book is officially out on the market, which will hopefully be, weeks, not months, then there will be a PDF edition available as well.
Well, I bookmarked it, so if you put it here, I'll know where I can go and buy it.
Cool. I'm very glad, by the way, that we got a printed edition, because I still prefer printed books over ebooks.
Now, you might have to work with Ken to get a print edition anywhere outside of U.S. Canada. Apparently, he has avenues to ship to Europe, the U.K., Australia, that kind of thing, but he kind of does it as one-off.
Shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, so drop Ken a line at Astra Games when you're ready to arrange for shipping, and he might be able to take care of you.
You can always have one of us buy it for you and send it to you.
Also possible.
Oh, yeah, I thought sorry, go ahead.
I still prefer PDF because, to quote Ghostbusters, print is dead.
I keep a pretty extensive research library. If we were using cameras, you could probably see my wall-to-wall bookshelves back here. But physical books take up space.
Yes, yeah, as someone who's been collecting a lot of video game strategy guides of late, I can my wife especially can attest to how much space they take up.
Yeah, the last time I moved to a new house was 25 years ago, and I got some friends to help me move. And during the cool down period after that, several of them swore they would never move anybody again unless they were illiterate.
Well, when I moved to where I'm at now, I needed to move my library. I just put my phone in my purse.
That helps.
It's weird. I honestly still love physical books. Like, I might, even though I have the PDF, I might buy this just to, one, support it, and two, because I love physical books. I still love them. I've been on a strategy guide buying spree because, like, so many of those aren't PDFs, and I'd rather, read that. Like, it's not a thing you can read when the plane is taking off. You can't read a PDF when the plane is taking off. So it's nice to have a print book.
Now, as to how this fits in with the rest of Ken's product line, Ken has several, it basically is part of his non-fiction products. He has several other pamphlets or books on various aspects of realistic, plausible, space travel, rocket science, things like that. The good news is at least one of them was nominated for a Hugo back in the day. The bad news was that was the year that the Hugo Awards were being really mired in controversy, so maybe an asterisk by that.
Which one? For several years.
That was back in 2015 or so, when there were some people gaming the nomination process. Now, Architect of Worlds is by far the heftiest book in the nonprofit line.
Well, he can tell that just by the price. All the other ones are $2, $3.
Oh, yeah. Those are all pamphlets. This is a full-length book, no kidding.
It is 191 pages.
Well, it's going to be a little longer even, because the final draft is going to be a touch longer than that. We're adding some forms in the back and I think Ken intends to make those available as a free download as well. So have a form to work with while you're designing your worlds, and you can have that.
If I may make it. Oh, God.
Well, I just was going to say, anytime you have a book called The Hot Equations, had I not known it's nonfiction, I never would have suspected.
mm-hmm. If I may make
now
a,
we're
an, oh good.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to make a stupid airplane joke. Go ahead. It's fine.
Yeah, Ken and I are talking about doing some follow-on products for Architect. Maybe some short pamphlets, more like the rest of his non-friction product line, just for new bits and pieces of science or special cases or what have you. And then, of course, in a few years, there might be enough new science out there to do a second edition, but I'm not even thinking about that yet.
Well, I mean, this one took almost a decade to write. And so much has changed just in that decade, you were saying.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The first time I had a full design sequence, the bulk of the book is a long design sequence where you can start with nothing and, okay, how many stars are in this star system and how are they arranged? Now take one of those. What are its planets arranged like? Then pick one of the planets. 9 times out of 10, probably you're going to want one that's more or less Earth-like. Okay, how Earth-like is it? Can you work out the surface conditions of it? That's like a 2/3 of the book is that design sequence. Well, the first time I had a complete design sequence for this whole process, it was probably about somewhere between 1/2 and 2/3 the length of the one I ended up with. Just because we've learned so much about possible exceptions to what we thought of as the right model. And every time we came up with an exception, I had to add more material in there. I'm fairly sure. I mean, yeah, it's a dense book. There's math. There's a lot of, you know, here's some of the science backing up each step. It's pretty dense. But yeah, you know, I feel like the model that we ended up with is going to take care of a lot. I actually have been patting myself on the back quite a bit lately because, okay, we see new exoplanets somewhere or a new case that people are, that real scientists are speculating about. And it's like, okay, yeah, Architect of Worlds can do that now. So I'm pretty happy with how it's going at the moment.
And you were saying pre-orders are pretty robust. I think you sounded surprised by that.
Well, the way it ended up being a Ad Astra Games project, I was working on this entirely as a labor of love. I fully expected to write the whole thing. I did all the layout, for example. I was the art director and the layout expert as well as the writer. I fully expected to finish producing it, produce a PDF, put it up on, say, DriveThruRPG or RPG Now, and sell maybe 6 copies. Because, yeah, it's going to be for a niche market. I've known Ken for years, and he was aware just by following my blog and my Facebook page that I was coming close to being ready to publish this. So last fall, he came to me and said, hey, how would you like to publish this through Ad Astra Games? Now, I think I let Ken believe that it took me a few weeks to think about that. It actually took about 15 minutes. Ken is an absolutely on-fire marketer, promoter. He is absolutely shameless about promoting his product line. He goes to conventions. He gets online. He sells everything he possibly can. Yeah, I wanted that for my book. So we came to a good arrangement as to exactly what royalties were going to be like. And already, even before the book is out, I've sold a couple orders of magnitude more than I would have, I suspect, if I'd been doing it on my own. So I am quite happy with this relationship. Ken's a good guy to begin with.
Yeah, he is. I'm sorry to hear he's not doing well, but it's I'm glad to hear he's also doing better. Mm-hmm. But no, I'm really happy to hear this is actually generating more interest than you anticipated, because I'm honestly not surprised, because there are crazy fans of things like this always in the woodwork waiting to come out, waiting for their thing. You know, it's like space video games. Like, they were long forgotten for a long time. And now once they started coming out, people were like, oh yeah, I remember these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have to attest, you caught me playing Crusader Kings 3 earlier, but, I'm a Mass Effect, junkie from way back. And, I used to play Elite Dangerous a fair amount. I got tired of that, mostly because I got tired of other people.
There are a lot of... you brought up Elite Dangerous. Oh, no. Oh, no.
Here we go.
Yes.
Here we go.
We have a long and sordid history with Elite Dangerous. We're also very tired of it. It's not just the other people made us tired.
I loved the fact that they had a decent map of the solar neighborhood. And you could actually visit a lot of these places that I've been studying for most of my life. But yeah, eventually I got tired of the actual gameplay.
Yeah. What gameplay? What gameplay?
That's the thing. I actually made the mistake of booting it up recently.
Just to
check out how it is.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And here's the thing. The things that are good about this game are the same things that were good about it 8 years ago.
Yeah, so, the sound design, the graphics.
Some bits that are enjoyable. There are some parts that can be fun if you want Elite, like Euro Truck Simulator in space. It hasn't changed. It hasn't added anything actually enjoyable in 8 years. It just added grind on top of grind on top of grind.
It's just,
I think there's a new space Starship Simulator coming out soon. I saw a Kickstarter for it that's just winding up and is well past its minimums.
There's a demo for it.
I think that's the one that I was looking at too.
What is it called?
Starship Simulator. There's a demo for it. There's not a lot of right now, but the demo looks promising for it. So yeah, we're definitely keeping an eye on that one.
It looks fancy. I'm cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, they're very, very almost Star Citizen levels of ambition. And that's the worry. That's the worry there. Very, very ambitious. And we're a little worried about that.
Yeah, that was my assessment too. It looks like if they manage to get maybe 2/3 of what they actually have planned to work, then it looks like it'll really scratch that itch for me and for a lot of other people.
Yeah.
They'll be able to pull it off is another question.
Yeah. When I see something like that, I'm like, okay, guys, start with like a solar system or like 10 solar systems. Start small and build from that. You know what I mean? Like, get your gameplay solid, get your mechanics working, you know, that kind of thing. Get all that in a small chunk and then build on that chunk. Don't be like, we're going to give you the whole universe with this huge detailed ship. It's like, whoa, 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 whoa. slow down, calm down.
Yeah. In fact, if you notice, they're actually promising more than Elite Dangerous ever did.
I know.
In Elite Dangerous, you're not going to come up out of the galactic disc. In this new thing, they're promising you the whole Halo, and it's like, whoa, okay, yeah, cool, I get to visit Omega Centauri, but that's a lot of space.
That is the issue. Yeah, we have all this space. What are you going to do with it?
How are you going to make it? How are you going to make it interesting? How are you going to make it fun?
We already have what's that like game/thing called like Space Engine, the one where you're just like
go through
observable space, and like engine, search for stuff.
Yeah, that's neat. Fact,
we have that.
A lot of the art in Architect of Worlds, I paid the producer of Space Engine a fee for their commercial license. A lot of the deep space imagery in Architect of Worlds is screenshots from Space Engine. it's a neat little thing.
I mean,
that's great.
Hey, I saw it. It looks great. It's very good. So
I love
no
that.
No complaints there.
I love that.
Did you guys get to see the full color draft?
No.
Yes.
Is that the one we were sent? Was color? I don't remember. Okay.
No, it has full color in the title, Brian.
Okay.
Does it? Okay.
It's in the final name.
A lot
of that space imagery kind of looks in black and white, which is going to be the print edition, but it really pops in the color PDF. So I'm hoping that's going to do.
Though the black and white will have a certain like retro appeal, I imagine.
possibly. Between that and, of course, NASA has published just about their entire back catalog of imagery for the public domain, so lots of good astrophotography from them. This was an easy book to be an art director for. I was able to find a lot of good pieces to drop in.
That's funny. it's amazing. Wait, what's the one thing we just talked about? Space engine? Is that what it's called? Space
yes.
engine. Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing that you paid those guys to help, to allow your use of their art. That's amazing. I love that. I love that connection.
Yeah. I know they, I'm not sure how many people have actually ever done that. I mean, it's a cool planetarium map. And I can attest to, at least for things like planetary movements and whatnot, they're absolutely on mark.
Awesome.
One thing I did notice is if you zoom into, say, a remote galaxy somewhere in the sky, what you see in Space Engine is not what you would see with an actual camera. It'll look like a galaxy, but it might be face on, whereas the actual galaxy is edge on, stuff like that. But still, it'll generate all sorts of good imagery for you, and I was able to make good use of that.
That's wonderful. That really makes me happy, because it's like the Space Engine folks have been pounding away at their product for years, and it's a terrific product, absolutely terrific product. So I'm really happy to hear there's a little bit of cross-pollination there. Makes me very happy. and you brought up Mass Effect, not the most realistic thing, but fun.
Loads of fun.
Frontier developer. Fun.
In fact, speaking of which pseudonyms I use, between the time when I was working for Steve Jackson Games and the time I decided, screw it, I'm going to start writing my own stuff, even if I never sell any of it, I spent about 5 years writing a ton of fan fiction. And I ended up writing a complete novelization of the entire Mass Effect trilogy with an extra novel on the end and a couple novellas in the middle, and it was a lot of fun, and I got lots of readers.
Where can you find those? In like Amazon, or do you
they're funny story. There was a time when somebody basically downloaded all of my Mass Effect fanfic, slapped stolen covers on it, and published it on Amazon.
Yo.
Their own byline. Yeah, that didn't
son of a
That you are a victim of that stuff. Oh my god!
That didn't last very long. It was apparently only up for maybe less than a week before someone noticed and reported it to Amazon. I think if you dig around to Goodreads, you can still find it. Not a big deal. I mean, I was more annoyed that somebody thought that they could actually get away with that. But no. I originally wrote all that on fanfiction.net under my Shuriken pen name, so you can probably find it there if you had to. Hang on a second. Let me see. Yes, here we go.
Yeah, maybe if you have a link, put it in the stream chat. That's the place for it. Yeah,
I'm just about to do that.
Great.
First volume. That's Mass Effect 1. The neat thing I thought about that, it was a great exercise in writing. I got to do a lot of the hard science fiction author tricks with Mass Effect, which of course took a little work, because Mass Effect is not what you would call hard SF in a lot of ways. But I also got to do a lot of writing the other, writing from a point of view other than your own. So the viewpoint character in my entire series isn't Shepard. It's Liara Tassoni.
Remind me who that is. I've played the second and third games.
Liara is the archaeologist.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah.
Blue
yeah.
Lady.
In Mass Effect 1, she's just an archaeologist. In Mass Effect 2 and 3, she's the Shadow Broker.
Right. Right, okay. Yes. I never got through the first one, but I did play the second and third. I definitely remember it now.
So it was kind of, everybody writes fan fiction when you're novelizing a computer game, everybody writes fan fiction from the viewpoint of the protagonist in the game. So I decided I was going to do something a little different. I wrote from the point of view of the protagonist's love interest, who, of course, in those games has a pretty big role over and above just their relationship with the protagonist. And it was a great writing exercise, and much to my amazement, I got thousands and thousands of views for that stuff. None of which translated into any interest in my original fiction. I kind of had to start from scratch there, but still, I had struggled for decades to write a novel. Actually, from start to finish, write a novel that would read well when I was done with it. Writing fan fiction taught me how to do that.
Oh, that's good. From what I understand, a lot of actual established authors do get their start, you know, figuring out how to do their craft by writing fan fiction. So it's definitely great for that, at the very least.
Well, and also these days with the traditional publishing industry in such shambles, let's face it, a lot of authors are doing some mixture of traditional publishing, self-publishing, writing fanfic, just so they could get out in front of an audience. So.
That seems reasonable. So wait, do you mean like going through a traditional publishing house, but also publishing themselves on Amazon, for example, that sort of thing, like they mix it up that way?
Yep, absolutely. A lot of it depends on, you know, a lot of authors that I know of. They might have gotten some books traditionally published, but the major publishing houses, as soon as the book is no longer profitable, it drops off their catalog. Well, there might still be readers out there who want it, so they'll take the rights back and republish it. I'm thinking of Reichsgur, if you've heard of him. If I understand his story correctly, a lot of his more popular space opera science fiction novels, they've been dropped from the main publisher's catalog, so now he's going to indie publishers, he's going to self-publication to make sure he gets out in front of an audience. It's a story I keep hearing, so.
I believe it. I totally believe it. It's got to be really hard right now to be an author. I mean, I always talk about how hard it is to be a game developer with all the games coming out, but it's got to be hard to be an author with
just... I can attest. Back when I was writing some fan fiction, I was also writing short fiction for the magazine markets.
Mm-hmm.
And I did some research. Of course, I was primarily interested in what were considered pro markets, that is, the ones that paid you enough that you might actually get yourself some science fiction and fantasy World of the World Association membership eventually. There's only about a dozen of those in the United States, for example, Asimov's, Analog, you know, a few like that. And they basically got on the order of 200 to 300 submissions for every one that they published.
Oh, God.
And which meant that their slush pile readers were constantly overwhelmed, which meant that you could be writing perfectly good fiction and still not get into print. I mean, I kind of had that experience. I was getting rejection slip after rejection, and they were good rejection slips. I would get the editor-in-chief writing me paragraphs about how much he enjoyed the story, but maybe tweak this and tweak that.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, none of that fiction ever actually got into Analog or Fantasy and Science Fiction or any of the magazines. And it hasn't gotten any better over time. So, yeah, it's really tough to succeed in those markets.
Man, like how can you be successful and be creative? It's got to be so difficult, you know, to be
have a day job.
Or be retired already.
I mean,
yeah.
Or
do it the way Larry Niven did it, inherit a pile of money.
I didn't know that's how Larry Niven did it.
I mean, it works.
Yeah, Larry Niven was very much a trust fund baby. He apparently came from a huge California real estate clan. So, you know, he went to university and he started writing. And he actually, I mean, this was back when you could still break into the magazines with relative ease. He actually wrote a few pieces in order to show off to his family that, yes, I'm not just, you know, messing around here. You can actually make money doing this. I think a lot of this is in some of his autobiographical notes in some of his collections. If you want to make a small fortune writing science fiction, start with a large fortune is one way to do it.
Damn.
Well,
that's not true.
That's so discouraging.
Now, I'm not saying that feels a bit, you know, maybe not counterintuitive, just...
It hurts.
It's painful.
It does.
Something, pitchforks, torches, guillotines.
Well, and all that was before Amazon basically took over the self-publishing market.
Which, and made things... Okay.
Publishing through Amazon is a great opportunity. It lowers the good news, it lowers the barrier to entry. You don't have to wait years for an agent. You don't have to wait years for the agent to find you a market. You can just write it and publish it. The bad news is it lowers the barrier to entry. So now everybody is self-publishing their stuff.
And then you add quote-unquote AI on top of that.
The thousands of novels being published on Amazon that were written by ChatGPT or something like that. Yeah. It's suffering. Kind of difficult to remain hopeful about this kind of thing. But yeah, if you have a day job and you're doing it as a part-time creative, that makes it a little easier to maintain balance.
And I'm guessing go ahead, Julie.
Well, I just wanted to say, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, I got paid to write about video games.
I was there with you back in the day.
And
when it was profitable, when it made money.
And the whole book thing for me started out one day during the pandemic when, you know, when someone, I won't say who it is, but someone in the game industry asked to be on the other show I'm on. And I said, "You're big time. Why? You know, why?" And he had a cousin who was an accomplished author. And then one day my sister says, "You know, your first class is on Saturday." And some advice she gave me, she said, well, the first day she said, write down the first thing that comes to mind. And I wrote this ongoing PTSD nightmare. And she liked it so much, it turned into a book. But her advice was, she said, know who you're writing for. Are you writing for yourself, or are you writing to make money? And I have a day job that, while it pays really well, nobody wakes up and says, I want to be an account executor for a living. And it's just, but yet I was also told, yes, but everybody wakes up and says, I want a good job and a family. And I said, well, touche. So this has been for me, and have this book and have this as, and I don't mean to gush so much over it, but I wish I'd had this when I first started writing.
Please gush.
Well, you know, and it's like, it is, for me, it is a desperately needed resource, especially for the second book, which I'm about halfway through, and it's starting to involve a lot of science, which quite frankly starts to go over my head, you know, Higgs, boson fields and things like this. And I said, oh my god, this is like,
well, a lot of that goes over everyone's head, unfortunately.
And so this is to me, and I know, I'm sorry if I hijacked this and made it about authors, but
no, I mean, this is a book, of course we're going to talk about that sort of thing.
To me, this is like as a desperately needed resource for someone like myself who is just starting out. You know, I've had a short story that was accepted for an anthology, which is coming out. But, you know, I have started to write novels, and this is the first one that, well, they've ever said, yeah, sure, you know, we'll publish and we'll help you out, and this is published for this for you. But, you know, I know Amazon, and my editor says this all the time, you know, the problem is people just push out self-published stuff. They don't bother to use beta readers. They don't bother to use line editors. I didn't, before I started down this road, I didn't even know what a line editor was. And so she said it kind of gives a bad name to a bad name to independent authors. But on the other hand, when I started to do this because I desperately needed a creative outlet, there was Garrison Keillor, before he got himself in a boatload of trouble, once wrote an article a long time ago in the local paper, the Tribune, and he said when he was bitching about self-published authors, he said, when I first got my first paycheck, I grabbed the paycheck and I ran up and down the cornrows. And he said, now you, anybody can write a book and just have just their cousin and their uncle read it. And I said, you arrogant piece of shit. I said, because there are a lot of authors out there and a lot of game developers whose work I never would have seen if it weren't for the internet. And if it weren't for the internet, I wouldn't have met anybody I'm talking to right now. Mm-hmm. And so I thank God for that. I know you're going to have to take the, throw a little few babies out with the virtual bathwater, but it lets people publish things like this, mm-hmm. you know? And it's like, if it weren't for the internet, I never would have heard about Steve Jackson. And I know I'm probably one of the few people that can go back to choose your own adventure books, but I really enjoy it. And Inkle Games.
That was a different Steve Jackson, by the way.
Was it really?
No. Yeah, there's a Steve Jackson in the UK, and there's a Steve, well, there and the Steve Jackson in the US. I think Sorcery was the Steve Jackson from the UK.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I was also confused by that. I thought it was the same. Confusing. I thought it was the same Steve Jackson who did, you know, Car Wars and all that stuff.
But yep, no, Steve Jackson in the US. That's Car Wars. That's Munchkin. That's GURPS. Yeah.
Gotcha. Oh my. Yep. Okay. I feel dumb.
I'm sure you guys have heard of this, but there's another resource I really have to recommend to anybody who's doing hard science fiction, right? Atomic Rockets. Yes, that was what I was about to bring up.
Yes, okay. We all love Atomic Rockets. There, yep. I wish I was smart enough to understand half of the stuff that they put out, but I am not. But you got to give them credit for all the work. Oh my God, all the work. Well,
that website is to space travel and rocket science as, and to a much greater degree than my book is to planetary science.
Yeah, it's astounding. It's an astounding resource. It's a
really great resource.
Oh my God, I wish I understood some of the stuff. I read it and my brain starts to shut down and cry, crawls into a corner. And Julie, I don't think we're trying to malign self-publishing. It's just, it's made things better and worse. Like a lot of things. It's made things better and worse. I mean, it's better in a lot of ways, but then you get, like we were talking about earlier, the people throwing a bunch of ChatGPT stuff together as a book. And throwing that out there, and you can find YouTube videos of people telling you how to do that, and it's that kind of gross stuff that makes us sad, that it takes away from the joy that it's all
from the people actually doing creative stuff.
Yeah, because, like yeah,
because it's a huge grift culture around doing that.
Yeah.
Well, in particular, if you're going to do any kind of self-publishing, you've got to be really, really careful because a lot of the firms that are out there offering support for self-publishing, are they vanity presses? Are you going to pay them a bunch of money and have no obvious impact on sales? That's one reason why I've been kind of leery of doing that kind of thing. Because everybody wants to be an author, and there are going to be people out there who are going to try and take advantage of that dream. So, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, there was an article in Google News that came across my news feed just this last week. Somebody had used three different AI programs, wrote a children's book, illustrated it with these programs, and put it out for self-publishing in a weekend. And I said, well, that's horrible. Mm-hmm. After somebody else, and like I put a year and a half effort worth of learning and lessons from this person. Yep. I mean, I'm blessed to have known a guy who knows a guy, but not everybody has that in their life. And
yeah, they come to a cold and it's easy to be taken advantage of. I think that also gets to something else you were saying, Julie, which is, are you writing for yourself or are you writing to make money? If you're creating to make money, then the world we're living in is not going to be kind. But mm-hmm. if you're doing it primarily for yourself and then you go looking for an audience, you might have better success. And you never know, the lightning might strike.
Well, you know, it's like, and Brian might not remember, but a number of months ago, I was on the show, and I said, she doesn't listen to this show. And my publisher said, fire your the other editor. I said, how can I fire your editor? She's your editor. And she started in along these vents, lines about me writing for money. And I said, I'm not doing this. I said, because this started out as, you know, I had a good friend that died during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like everybody, you were stuck here at home and a career that pays well with no creative outlet. And this was, and I know I'm not the only person I know that suffers from PTSD. And this has gone a long way to help that. And change writing has changed my life. And so, again, I know I'm gushing about your book, but, you know, thanks for writing it. And I'll give you a little blurb in the back of my book when it comes out. Thanks.
I guess what we're trying to say is, folks, if you think you have a creative outlet, pursue it. You never know where it's going to take you. Just be careful.
Absolutely.
Just be careful.
Absolutely.
Because someone could mess up your stuff. AI could try and take it away from you.
Well, I think we're all at risk for that. But,
God.
At the very least, we ought to get to enjoy what we write for a while first, right?
Before the robots take over and kill us all? Yeah.
So, any other questions about the book or about Steve, or not Steve Jackson, Ad Astra?
I don't have any. Anybody else? Or should we start? Oh, go ahead. Go.
I have one question. When you wrote your book, did you have a particular? I go out to the Ad Astra, and there's a lot of products out there. And mm-hmm. when you first started down this road to write this book, did you have one of their particular products in mind?
I did not. I deliberately designed the book to be game system agnostic. It uses standard international units. You know what we Americans call metric. There are a few units in the book that are for convenience sake that aren't SI, things like Earth masses or solar masses or astronomical units. Those are just convenient. But by and large, it's the kind of thing that, yeah, you could design your piece of space and convert it to any game system you want, and it would work just fine because we're talking about the real universe here. At one point, I did, and this may be an early supplementary product. About 3 years ago, I did a abbreviated version of Architect of Worlds specifically for the tabletop game Traveler. Anybody who's played Traveler, you know, you have the, even if you're not digging into all the scientific detail, the very first three black books had a system where you could randomly generate worlds for your characters to visit. Well, I built a abbreviated version of Architect of Worlds that could produce exactly that. And especially because if you do just the random dice method that they have, occasionally you get worlds that aren't physically very likely. But, you know, the Architect of Worlds, one of the reasons I've been fascinated by this all these years is to find ways to do it plausibly, to sort of patch over those possible errors. So that'd be a nice short, I think it's only 4 or 5 pages long. It would have to be updated because that was 3 years ago and Architect of Worlds has changed quite a bit since then. But Ken has a Traveler license from Mark Miller, so he tells me it would be pretty trivial to publish that through Ad Astra. Of course, Ad Astra has their attack vector and squadron strike, you know, the fairly complex, but very playable. I know I've sat through a few sessions myself.
Having combat. Played both of them, they are very fun. They're also for insane people.
There's a lot of detail to keep track of, that is for sure. So yeah, you could very easily build stuff with Architect of Worlds that you could then port right into a Squadron Strike campaign or something like that. So
yeah, it's folks, if you're of a certain mind, you will love this thing. It is super impressive. It's so technical, it broke me. That's how impressive it is. And I'm not saying that negatively. I am not very smart. It's just,
you know, a book is good when it features an entire section on varying and expected value on page 4.
Yeah, that was deliberate. I mean, a lot of these systems, you roll the dice, you plug in the equation, and you're expected to take that value. Well, fact of the matter is, a lot the models in Architect, a lot of the models that we work with in science are only approximate. The real world is going to vary. So here you go. This is what your expected value is going to be, but feel free to tweak it. Yeah.
Page 4, everyone. Page 4.
Well, John, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us about your very complex, but not complicated book. It is a complex book, folks, but I got through 20 pages of it, which is more than I thought I would. So that's impressive. It's definitely.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk about it. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So, folks, again,
I have read it. I have read it to completion myself. I haven't understood it to completion.
You made it farther than I did. You have a more impressive brain than I. My goodness. Go ahead.
Nothing.
Okay. So, folks, thank you for listening. Next week on the show, we're actually going to have another guest. We're going to bring back the developer of Underspace, which just hit early access today, April 10th, 2024. If you liked Freelancer from 2003, just buy this. Just go buy it. It's $18, I think, right now. Just freaking buy it. It's so good. It's so good. I think I'm going to stream it again tomorrow because I ended on a dour note today, and it was an easy fix. And so I think I'm just going to stream it again tomorrow. It's so good. It's so good. So go stream. Go buy it. So, yeah, we're going to welcome back the developer of Underspace on next week. Second guest in a row after a long drought of guests. So, John, thank you again for taking the time to come on and talk to us. Folks, it's called Architect of Worlds. We've put the link in the chat, but we'll definitely include it on the website once the MP3 of this goes up. It's a print. Right now, it's $35 to pre-order the print, not PDF, print edition, if you like that sort of thing, and you should.
Plus shipping.
Yeah, print stuff is important. Having a physical copy of a book is great. So please go check it out if you haven't already. And thank you so much for listening. And as we always end every show, please get your vaccines. Please wear your masks. The pandemic isn't over. We don't know when it's going to be over. We don't know when this is going to get to endemic stage. Is that how you say it properly? It's going to become, yeah. It's going to move to the endemic stage. It's going to not be a pandemic anymore. We don't know when that's going to happen. The last big flu pandemic, that was what, 8 years? So, please get your shots, wear your masks, do trust the science, get your flu shots too. I just mentioned the flu, get your flu shots, just get all the shots, people, if you can afford it, if you're able, please do so. Thank you as always to our patrons who help us, pay for things like Restream so we can all chat to each other on the streams that we talk on. And, with that, we'll see you back here tomorrow for more Underspace. We're going to play more Underspace. Have a great one, y'all. Bye-bye. I'm